back to the Tell It Like It Is podcast, where leading female founders, industry trailblazers, and all-around badass women tell it like it really is. I'm your host, Cassandra Ray. My guest today is co-CEO of Catalyst Constellations. She has supported teams across the tech behemoths Amazon, Facebook, Google, and Vodafone, as well as entrepreneurs and small business owners around the world. A social scientist by training, she spent 12 lightning-fast years at Microsoft, where she worked at the intersection of technology, design, and innovation, alongside co-founding the Ethnographic Praxis in Industry Conference.
Well done.
That's a mouthful. She is also the co-author of the book, Move Fast, Break Shit, Burnout, The Catalyst Guide to Working Well, coming out this fall, 2020. Also, she has the best last name in the history of last names. Please join me in welcoming Tracy Lovejoy. Tracy, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me, Cassandra. This is pure joy.
It is pure joy. Now, I know it's early for you in Seattle. I'm here in London, so it's afternoon here. How are you doing? Do you have a cup of coffee?
I do have a cup of coffee. It's actually a double cup because I knew we were sitting in for a conversation.
Yes. Yeah. Let's get into it right away. So I want to start with something that seems potentially part of your past. I know it happened a long time ago, but I feel like it's the only place to start, which is the Ethnographic Praxis in Industry conference that you co-founded in 2005.
Yeah.
First of all, what the hell is ethnographic praxis?
Right. What a great question. So most of us refer to it as EPIC. And what is ethnographic praxis? So my training, my master's was a social science program where I was focusing in anthropology and ethnographic methods. And ethnographic methods are a form of research that were born from anthropology and sociology, where you go and you observe people and you study people to understand, you know, humans and culture and really think about what's happening for us. We see this, you know, in famous anthropologists like Margaret Mead or Geertz. So when I came to Microsoft and I left the academic world, I didn't have a lot of colleagues. It was pretty rare to have someone that came from my background and was tasked with going out and studying people using technology live. And I would try to go to conferences like the American Anthropological Association, but they at the time were still very, very tied to the university world and didn't have a lot of respect and a lot of welcomeness for those of us that had moved to the corporate world. And so the founding of EPIC with Ken Anderson was to create a safe space for those of us that had moved from the academic world into the corporate world to talk about the work we were doing, because we really didn't have a place to do that. The name I can attribute to a former colleague and friend of mine, Nellie Steele. She was my neighbor at Microsoft. We had offices next to each other and we were like, well, we should have the word ethnography. It's what binds us. And we toggled with practice or praxis, because praxis is the more formal way to talk about the practice of something. And I think that we were trying to sound kind of, I don't know, real, cool, like we were actually something, you know, kind of that, like, the academic world doesn't want us, so we want to sound legitimate. Yeah. If we were renaming it today, you know, what are we, 15 years later? I think I would have gone with something else. But the ethnography part.
EPIC is a good name.
EPIC is
a good name.
Yeah, agreed.
EPIC is very good. So I don't know much about the practical application of ethnography, but just in terms of my own little network and circle, the only companies or organizations that I know that regularly use ethnographers, anthropologists, as what they are tech firms. Is it widely used outside of the industry of tech?
It's used anywhere people really want to study in-person behavior. So if you think of research broadly, research is a way that we answer a set of questions we have. And then, you know, I'm a research geek here, forgive me. So we pick the method of research based on the type of questions we want to answer. So classically, if you think of an Amazon, they like to know how many, you know, how many people click this button instead of that button. And so that type of research is going to be using data analytics. They also, even at Amazon, as you said, with tech, will have the questions of how do people, why do people? When you get into that range of questions, then you're going to be moving to a method that's more akin to observation or interview. Mm. And so in the Epic community, I've met people that work across a field of industries. You know, government for decades has used ethnographers and anthropologists to help them make sense of, you know, what's happening in tribal territories, for example, or minority populations. Banks often use ethnographic help. Retail services like, you know, Target, because they want to understand what is the shopping experience and how do we maximize that. You can't answer those kinds of questions with analytics unless they're shopping online. So whenever you have something that you want to understand about people's, you know, day-to-day life, that's when it comes into play. But certainly the tech companies led the way in this particular field for sure.
Interesting. And how did you make the leap from being a corporate ethnographer, if that's the correct term for what you were, to, you know, working now with corporate teams and individuals to help them and optimize their performance?
Yeah, the longer story is that it's aligned to what my natural strengths are. And when you look at my flow from that perspective, it's a very linear path. If you look at my resume, it looks like a very jagged path. But from my earliest memories as a girl, the way I was in the world is people kind of tuned into me in a very comfortable way and would tell me their life story. So going to research was actually a way to help me refine my way in the world, because as a child and as a teenager, that was kind of overwhelming. And so as I began to learn different ways to mitigate what was my natural experience, I could control interactions in a better way. And so research was one lens, and it allowed me to do this thing that I was good at and became a hobby of, you know, just getting to know people and understand their stories. And I was paid to do it, which felt like such a like boondoggle, which was amazing. And so I was sent all over the world to do these things. And then I had my first child, and my boss at the time was lovely and said, I'm guessing you don't want to travel as much. You have a lot of leadership. We'd love to have you begin to manage people. That was the first time that natural ability got put to use in a really direct way, where I could really see the person in front of me, ask the right question, and help them make sense of their life. That was a very natural step into coaching. And when I jumped into a coaching class, kind of head first, it's kind of my story in life, not really knowing what I was getting into, thought of it as continuing education for fun. I'm, you know, one of those lifelong learners. And it was disruptive in that I realized it was a calling, that everything had really led up to that. Coaching is taking that natural talent, that empathy, that ability to listen, and completely helping the person in front of them unlock themselves. And that wasn't part of the plan in 2010 when I started in coaching training. So I started setting baby goals, as we all do, and, you know, like, okay, well, I'll finish my training and then I'll get my certification and I'll see if my bosses are happy if I do some coaching here. I explored if Microsoft would want a full-time coach, which at least at the time, that wasn't a position that they hired for. And so eventually it was so loud for me and so present, and just, it was my joy that I couldn't ignore it. I was coming up on my 40th birthday. And so my husband and I were like, let's take the leap. Let's see what happens when you really lean into this thing that feels like a calling. So it felt like a left turn if you were watching my career, but it was a completely straight path for me as a human being.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, I feel like coaching is such a crowded field now. Mm. Like, you know, the industry is not super regulated, and what regulation exists is really divergent in a lot of places. Yeah. And frankly, you know, I would say arguably fairly lax. And it does feel like everyone can just slap the title coach on their LinkedIn profile and then go out and get some clients. And a lot of people do.
Yeah.
How, I think you've answered the question, you know, why did you wade into that crowded swamp? But on the other side, if you are somebody who feels like I need some help to make sure that I can achieve my full potential or to, you know, unlock myself, as you've put it, how can that person know the difference between somebody who took a night class and got a certification and somebody who's really good at this and will really create some value?
Yeah, that's a great question. The most common way, of course, is referral. And so if you have someone that you know and respect that has worked with someone that has helped them transform in ways that are meaningful, that's going to be your number one. And that's similar to how we find everything in life, whether it's, you know, someone to help you with your electricity or someone, a coach to transform your life. How can you wade through, you know, kind of the difference? This is such a good question and tougher. Because the answer I'll give will seem almost flippant in the face of the beautiful question you've asked, is that certainly you want to talk to them and get a sense of fit, right? You always want to have, the way we talk about it in coaching is discovery, to see what does this person offer? What does it feel like to work with them? You know, how do they work with you? How do you lean in? But someone who would be really skillful at kind of hoodwinking you would be great in a half hour or an hour to trick you, right? So that's where I get a little tripped up on your question of, you know, is that really enough? That's a tough question. And then I point back to referral, or the best way you can to get a sense of really understanding how this person works and what the transformation is they promise. Are there metrics that they use? You know, how do they provide what you want? The other thing is that for someone seeking coaching, the best time to seek coaching is when you have clarity on your goals and what you want to achieve. And then you can really talk to that person about what they see as their role in helping you step toward those. I think probably the biggest risk is when you're not clear, because coaching is different than therapy in that you enter coaching when you say, you know, this is what I want to achieve within this time frame, and I'd really like to work with someone to help me grow my self-awareness, to help me create accountability, to help me, you know, be a partner as I move through the hurdles and challenges that I know are ahead. If you're just saying, I just want to coach, but I don't know what I'm working on, then it would be incredibly hard to understand if the person in front of you could be helpful. I don't know anything meaningful there.
No, I think you did. And I think, you know, we all know coaching isn't therapy, but you know, there is definitely an overlap there.
Sure.
And I recall seeing some therapists in my life and always being really frustrated, because I would ask like right in the beginning, you know, what does good look like here?
Right.
How do you know you're good at your job?
Right.
What can I expect? And the answer was always kind of, you know,
right,
this is a long process and we don't really have metrics. And I remember thinking, what a great industry to be in where I won't know if this is going to work or add any value to my life until I've spent thousands of dollars with you. And then we can gauge if I've moved the needle at all. So this word catalyst, which I know you've been using for a long time, Let's unpack that a little bit. I mean, is that from social science or is that just, you know, coaching mumbo jumbo?
Neither, actually. It's more Tracy mumbo jumbo. This was much more about kind of the building of my business. I was not an intuitive entrepreneur. And so when I left Microsoft and started my own consulting and coaching business, I worked with a wonderful coach. And one of the things that she had me do is, as you look for who you want to serve, go out and do interviews. And I kept going out and kind of looking at what are considered standard niches in the coaching industry, like looking at demographics of people at a certain age, a certain transition, a certain industry, or, you know, female small business owners, people, executives in tech, whatever. And it just, none of it really excited me. But I realized as I looked through the people I'd interviewed, as I looked through the people I had been working with over the years, there was always a set of people I leaned into. And so I went backwards to try to make sense of that. And like, what was it that these people had in common? And when I did that analysis, I had like 7 pages of total mumbo jumbo of like what binds them. Things like they always showed up with their homework done for coaching. They always leaned into the places the challenges were coming up rather than shut down and were like, no, I'm not going to deal with this. They set these extraordinary goals that even they were scared of when they first set it, but they would push past that fear. And often by the next session, they would forget that they were afraid. So I was trying to make sense of this. I didn't have a word for it. There's not a perfect word. Catalyst is not a perfect word. But I was down at the Tully's coffee shop. I kind of look out my window here and see where that used to be. And I was meeting with a client who was part of that group of clients that I, you know, had done my personal analysis of. And he said, I had a revelation over the weekend. He said, I'm a catalyst. I come up with these ideas and I move into action. And I was like, that's it. That's the word. And so it was that year that I actually started doing really structured research with these group of people that would identify with that term catalyst. This was in 2016. And I adopted that word. I played with lots of other words. I've looked at other words out there. And as I said, it's imperfect, but it's the best I see, right? From a structural perspective, a catalyst in chemistry is something that drops into the water and creates a chemical reaction. It typically remains unchanged, which is not true when we're talking about people, right? We are very changed as catalysts as we drive positive change forward. But I like this word because it shows it's, you know, it's someone who's helping start things. It's someone who's creating something bigger than themselves. From the research I now have, you know, a specific way I'm defining what I mean in that term and who we work with. But the more general meaning of the term related to people is a good enough umbrella, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. You know, one of the things that I think sets you apart from that crowded swamp of coaches as well is that you do bring a scientific mind to your work. Yeah. And I would imagine that your history and training as an ethnographer really helps. And just what you said, you know, in 2016, I started doing research about this. I mean, that really does set you apart because, again, I feel like there's a lot of coaches out there and they even, some of them even write books, right? But books that are often full of platitudes and cliches or their opinions presented as fact. And I don't like to interview those people, but I really love talking to you because you do bring a real depth of understanding with and a curiosity to go explore and say, oh, I've got a hypothesis. Let me drill down on this a little bit more.
Well, thank you.
So I'm super, you're welcome. I'm super interested in the book.
Yeah.
Not only because it feels like you wrote it just for me, but also because Move Fast, Break Shit, Burn Out. I mean, who among us cannot relate to that? So can you just tell me a little bit about what you're trying to achieve in the book, what you've done to write it?
Yeah. So I'll start with the what we've done to write it and then the what we will achieve. So the book is a synthesis of the research that started in 2016 and continues to this day. I don't ever think I'll stop doing research with this population. And so what we're trying to achieve is it's essentially the working manual for ourselves as catalysts, because we have such a, going a little deeper into the definitional part of who we are taking in information around us very quickly, and we're synthesizing that into opportunities, ideas, possibilities of how the world around us can change. We do that in our household, like the sofa needs to be over here, in our relationships, both, you know, spouses, friends, children, in our workplace. To us, this is perfectly natural, and we assume everybody in the world always wants to optimize and be better, and why wouldn't you? right? And we set incredibly high goals about how we want to change the world for the positive. We have, you know, strong opinions on how it can be better. And we move to action. It's not just that we have the thought, we're not just the visionaries, but we almost can't stop ourselves. It's like before we even are aware that the thought has happened, we are putting things in place to get us to move to that point. And so it can feel like magic. Mm. We are very naturally iterative. And so that, you know, growth mindset is, you know, a big term right now. That growth mindset is a natural way of being for us, that we just set the vision, move to action. And as we take those steps, we're iterating really, really quickly. So the problems, there's so many for us, is that we're driving everyone around us crazy, but we don't know it because we're so in service of the ideas, right? We're alienating our spouses. We're pissing people off in the workplace because we move so fast and we break shit. We're breaking trust. We're breaking the model that our, you know, colleague just built and telling them that their baby's ugly. And then we're so in service of that idea. And we take so much energy at first from tackling new, exciting challenges that we're not monitoring our own energy. And we burn out with very, very patterns that are so replicable. So in the research, this was just so over and over and over. You could see like, yeah, I start this new job and I jump in and then, you know, I'd start to piss people off and I'd hit the resistance and then burnout would set in. And there's much more detail. So the hope with the book
I have to tell you, I am like relating to every single word you say. It's like a fireworks display of aha moments going on for me. So please continue, but I just wanted to give you that feedback.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that. And so the book is to help us see our own process and ideally give us the tools and wherewithal to slow it down for our own sake. And for the sake of actually being more effective at creating the change that we so desperately want to make.
Yeah, absolutely. My time is better spent somewhere else.
Yeah.
So I want to switch gears a little bit because I know in your company, Catalyst Constellations, you've chosen a co-CEO model.
Yes.
Now, that's not totally unheard of, but it's also fairly rare. Why did you decide to share power, share the title, share authority in that way, rather than say name one as CEO and one as COO, as often happens?
Sure. It's so funny even hearing that question because it was never even a thought of sharing power or authority. So gosh, I just love that as a challenge. It goes back to kind of knowing myself. When I was first in business for myself, I have many values, as we all do, but two that were constantly in competition. One is the desire for autonomy, and the other is the love of collaboration. And I also have a learning style when I look back on my own career and even before being in career that I love to work closely with someone and study them, right? This is my natural ethnographic ability because I'm able to emulate them, take on what's great, see what doesn't work. And then I'm ready to kind of move on to the next person. And so even from childhood, like I was always the teacher's pet. I know that's so super annoying, but true. And so as you go on up through my career, I was always the right-hand person of my boss because it would allow me to study what it meant to be at that next level of leadership. And so all of a sudden when I was on my own, I didn't have anyone to study. It was very hard becoming the owner of a consulting business. I didn't know how to figure it out because who do you study when you're building it yourself? And so I kept kind of going into partnerships and being a subcontractor as a way to learn things. And I would be drawn into partnerships that weren't necessarily as healthy for me because they could compromise that autonomy, right? Especially if it is that relationship of someone being in charge. Shannon and I started working together as an aside. It was a side hustle for us. So during the course of my research, she had already been a client and I interviewed her as one of the catalysts. And at the beginning of our hour, she said, I have this group of entrepreneurs around the globe that I've gathered in very catalyst fashion. And I've always wanted to get them together in a house. Would you be willing to help me facilitate that? That was the birth of what we now build together as Catalyst Constellations. I am not a natural person that gathers people. I have my own, you know, kind of my fears and shortcomings. Like my, the easiest way to say it is I always have that fear nobody's coming to my party. So while I love the one-on-one work, I'm not great at building communities. I will start Epic. I've started communities, but I always, even there, I had a co-founder, right? Someone who's really comfortable in the gathering of people. I also don't, I love moments like this where I get to talk about my work and be one-on-one, but being in the spotlight consistently is hard for me. So even going to Epic today where it's, you know, there's a mystique of like, oh, you're a co-founder, is hard for me. So as Shannon and I started building retreats together, which is what it became, it wasn't just the gathering of her friends in the end. We also started talking about our vision for these people that we have the shared affinity for. And it was eerie how similar it was. And so it was never almost really a choice of the sharing of power. It was just something we were doing together. She became, you know, she really saw how this was a calling for her. And so it was like, hey, I'd love to do this full time. We didn't even know what that meant at first. And it wasn't until she left her job in Ericsson last fall that we really started saying, what would this look like? She has such set of strengths and talents that are different than mine, that marketing side, that reaching out, that building of community, whereas mine is about the research, that one-on-one, that depth, that there was no stack ranking. You know what I mean? Like they're both so essential to the business we're building. And we see each other as such equal partners that it wouldn't have made sense. It didn't even occur to us to be anything but co-leaders, if that makes sense. There could be one day structurally that we say, oh, I am more of this than this. But that would be more functional and again, related to our strengths and what we want to do and what we're leaning toward and what's giving us energy than it is about who has authority. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. Yeah. And how have you guys handled conversations around money?
Yeah. So we, Shannon was brilliant in this area and she said, I think we need a coach. And so we found a coach who is, both a therapist and a coach, which was great because we essentially had to go through pretty intense couples counseling. And it's funny now in a very Catalyst fashion, because we'd be like, can't we meet twice this week for 2 hours each? Like, you know, couples counseling is usually the commitment for forever, but we're like, but we need that operating agreement in 6 weeks. Right. And so she brought us through this process that was, oh my gosh, the migraines I had, Cassandra, were insane. Of like, let's go back to your family of origin. What did conflict look like for the two of you? When do you check out? What can this person expect from you? Where do they set you off? What are the triggers? Where do you celebrate this person? What are you afraid of in this person? And it was like, and the conflict that both of us have, we both have some conflict avoidance, right? And so, but we were slightly different and we had fears of how we might alienate the other in slightly different ways. Oh, it was so painful. It was so painful to go through this process, but it gave us tools and it helped us build trust and understand each other so that we could lean into places. And I think that I think money is a much more easy to talk about topic for Shannon than it was for me. I grew up, we were certainly never poor, but my mom was a single mom. My dad, you know, kind of never sent the proverbial check. She got laid off when I was in sixth grade. And so, you know, it wasn't easy. And so money was always something I struggled with. My dad was very wealthy, so I kind of equated money with evil, right? So for me to have these conversations and to admit like, yes, I'd like wealth. I'd like for us to be really successful. That is the path that I see us on was hard. And so if I didn't have that coach / therapist, in this case, really worked for me, it really was necessary work to get through to have those conversations. So now we have to trust each other to lean in and have those hard conversations. And we were just doing this another day. And as Catalysts, right, we're both Catalysts ourselves. I feel like we build a new piece of our business like every other day. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, Shannon threw out, hey, given our partner agreement, I'd love to understand how this piece is going to fit into how we pay ourselves, who gets what, right? And so it's become this, like, we have to hold ourselves accountable to saying things that may feel hard. And we trust the other person so much and have so much love and understanding. We know that like if our feelings get hurt, we have to deal with that. because we understand that partnerships like this can so often go awry because of those unspoken feelings that begin to build up. So it's a process, and it's a marriage as much as a partnership.
Yeah, I think that's really, really well said, and something that when I talk to entrepreneurs or in myself have had, you know, different projects I've done with people, building a business with somebody is like a marriage.
Yes.
And, you know, it does take the same amount of work and communication. It has very similar pitfalls and can, I think, potentially have the same, you know, similar rewards on the other side as well if you can get through to the other side.
Agreed.
Yeah, but it's more than just what you put down on a paper. I think that's what's so interesting about what you've said. It's, you know, we have a partner Absolutely. Agreement, but that's just what's on the paper. We now have to discuss how yeah. we feel about it, and, you know, how it presents itself as our business evolves.
100%. And we have to have enough of that psychological safety between us to just say, like, I screwed up here. I just need to own something, right? And to trust that the other person's going to be okay with that.
Yeah.
And that's not always easy, right? We are both very high functioning, high performing, high ambition people. And so to be like, you know, if I'm only accountable to myself as the solopreneur, as the key leader, I don't have to say that to anybody, right? If I don't want to. But in a partnership, you really do have to be willing to be like, I messed up, and I'm going to trust that you're going to be okay with that. That takes a lot of work.
Yeah, I'm sure. So I want to end on a few quick-ish fire questions. These can go fast or slow, but
okay.
What's one lesson you learned the hard way?
Oh, empathy first. I, as a catalyst, I didn't have that word in my youth, but especially as a people manager, it was always about the like doing the best work, being in service of the work. And I have moments of deep regret that I didn't just sit down and have the conversation and understand what's happening for you here. You know, what's happening? Is it possible that this environment isn't the right for you? Are my expectations off? Like, what's getting in the way for us? So empathy first.
Mm-hmm. And how did you learn that was missing? I mean, you said that you sort of studied, the people above you, or became the right hand person to the person above you. Is that a model that you saw that you wanted to, you know, emulate, or did it come from your research, or how did you learn that?
It evolved. Once I became a manager, I became quite a fan of reading a lot of leadership books. And I took as many classes as Microsoft would allow me. And so I, you know, kind of got to have a wonderful mini education that way. I also experienced it and stepped in the pitfalls, which is, I think, always some of the best ways we learn. So there's one particular person that I still hold. I should just reach out to her, to be honest, that I still hold a tremendous amount of guilt of how I dealt with our relationship early in my management career. Of, you know, kind of sitting more in accusation than listening and like, this is what we agreed to. Why haven't you done it? Right. Like, I was in the right, if you will, but the end point just felt so wrong. And there was a different way to get to the same place that could have been managed through understanding and conversation as opposed to righteousness. That education continued. There's another event that I started right as I left Microsoft with, again, another co-founder, Gaina Williams, and it was targeted at the design and user research, the UX community. And we had a series of, at the time, VPs of design that came into, and we just had them share their life lessons. And that was a very rare title back in 2013, much more common today. And I went back and did research. I looked across all the transcripts of those interviews to pull out the wisdom. And I was shocked, even though I had just come out of 12 years of actually doing this work, that the number one thing they said is you have to study the people around you to be successful in your career. That it's not just about going out and studying the customers, which is what they, you know, these people are tasked to do in their employment, but you have to study your boss and your boss's boss and the people around you. And it was such an aha of that training that I had, applying it directly to your team, to your people, is always going to help you find the path forward. Coaching training, of course, reinforces this. And then now the research with Catalyst, this is one of our biggest gaps. And it's interesting, as you know, I said that Catalyst take in lots of information. A natural stream of information we have is emotional intelligence. Even if you don't score high on emotional intelligence, I find that people can use it to build their visions. However, we very rarely use it once we begin to move into action. We don't look at, like, as I present the vision, we don't look around the room and say, like, did people cringe? Did people like pull back in fear? Did everybody sit silently? And we just assumed that meant they all understood it.
Yeah.
And so it's been a growing learning for me over and over and over.
Yeah. I think when you're in a zone and you have an idea that you're so enthusiastic about and you've got this vision and, you know, at least my perspective is if I communicate it to a room and they don't get it, it honestly never occurs to me that maybe the idea is not a good one or, you know, or whatever. I'm always like, oh, they don't get it. Let me just move on. Let me just do it.
Right. You know? And in the book, we don't actually advocate that we think your idea is bad because we know as a catalyst, Cassandra, that you're going to iterate based on as you take steps forward, right? You're going to begin to move it into action and you're going to see what the marketplace can take. Marketplace as a synonym for whatever it is, right? The team, the globe. But what we do say is that, you know, if you really look at how do humans experience change, it's a process and there's a grieving process. Every change we experience some grief. We as catalysts really don't take that into account, that sometimes we are just leaving a wake of chaos and grief and not helping the people around us move through that in a more effective way. Yeah. Even though we have the natural tools to do it. It's very interesting, our blind spot. Yeah.
Yeah. I can definitely relate to that. If anything, you're like, why aren't you praising me more for making this change? Like, I don't understand.
Like, exactly,
where is my adoration? Like,
exactly.
100%. Okay. What's an opinion you once held strongly that you've since changed your mind about?
Well, I think there's 1,000, but for me, usually that's more iterative. So I'll be really, really specific. I used to dislike the show Sex and the City because I saw like random episodes as opposed to the whole story.
The storyline.
Yeah. And I just saw these like white, wealthy, entitled women whining about being independent, but secretly just really wanting a partner.
Yeah. That's a valid also interpretation.
But when I sat and watched them in order, I was nursing my second and you know, you have the middle of the night feedings. And so I would pick a show that I would commit to, a short show that was a comedy.
Mine was West Wing, yep.
There you go. Yep. And so I would, you know, watch a little bit every night over the course of you know, the year that we'd have together in the middle of the night. And I saw this story of friendship emerge and I realized that it was really a story about women supporting women when you looked at it develop over time. So that was an opinion switch for me of like, oh, okay. If I take the time and slow down and don't just judge something based on the single episode out of order, maybe that's not the best moment to have a judgment. So that's what I've slept on.
I loved that series, but when you just described your very first interpretation of it, I was like, huh, I wonder if I was watching it now, you know, in the history that we have now, all the things that have become more present. If I might also think what you thought the first time. And I think potentially they can both be true.
Agreed.
There probably was, you know, a little bit self-indulgent, little bit story about privileged girls, living it up in Manhattan.
Yep.
And also a beautiful story of friendship.
I completely agree. It's not that the opinion totally shifted. It's just not as strongly on that side. I also see some of the beauty there now too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So speaking of white privileged Manhattanites, what unearned privilege or unfair advantage has been most instrumental to your success so far?
There's a lot. right? I come from a lot of privilege. I grew up very, very upper middle class. So wealth, exposure to wealth, excellent education, and probably education is the biggest, the not only experiencing it when I was young, but then getting the opportunity to continue into university, into graduate school. Having teachers and mentors that were invested in me it is an incredible privilege, that has supported everything I've done. But the truth is, as you asked that question, there's so much gratitude I am filled with every day that really so much of the experience I've had has been given to me. And I'm very, very aware of that. Very aware.
What are you still insecure about?
Oh gosh, my weight. Am I going to be found out as an imposter? Is my, is the research that, you know, we're publishing the book on robust enough? Am I really a good enough researcher to call myself that? Like all the things. Am I a good mother? Oh, that's probably the loudest. I have a 13-year-old and a 9-year-old, and that constant replaying of like, did I break the children? Are they really going to go out and be able to live a life and not look back and be in therapy forever? I mean, maybe they all will, but that's the loudest. That's the loudest insecurity for sure, because you're in the moment all the time faking it as a parent every day.
Yeah, or just being in the moment, doing your best.
Totally. Yeah. Totally.
Yeah.
But they think we know, right? And we have to act like we know, but we don't really know.
We don't know.
We don't know.
But we do know more than them.
Maybe.
But we do know more than them.
Yeah.
About most things. Like we definitely know sugar is bad for you.
Right.
Like, you know what I mean? Like we definitely know that.
Fair enough.
We definitely know you need a good night's sleep. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. When do you feel you're most powerful?
Mornings. I'm such a morning person. And so my brain isn't foggy. I feel clear. I feel ready to kind of tackle anything. It's this gift of a reset every night for me. And after spending time with girlfriends, with female friends, and or my sister, who I put in that category, there's laughter. There's so much confidence building. There's so much love. And so I kind of feel like I can go out and do anything knowing that I have that in me and with me and behind me.
How old are you now, Tracy?
46. I'll be 47 in November.
47. So if you could go back and tell your 27-year-old self anything, what would it be?
Oh, trust your instincts. Right? Like we always hear this, but now, you know, we have all these years to like, was it right? And sometimes, right, because you're not always sure which part of the voices in your head to listen to, it wasn't exactly right. But for the most part, even when I didn't understand why my instincts were moving me somewhere, absolutely trust your instincts.
And if you and I meet in 20 years' time and I say, if you could go back and tell your 47-year-old self anything, what do you think it will be?
Oh, you're not as fat as you think you are. Go out and do it anyway. You've really got nothing to lose. They say that your 20s and 30s are your peak, but no way. Your 40s are absolutely 40s and 50s. Like so much of the insecurity has like, yes, I still have insecurities, but for the most part, they're so quiet compared to my 20s and 30s.
That's a perfect way to put it. It's that the insecurities are there, but they're just so much more quiet.
Yeah. Like, it's just like, fuck it. Go fucking do it. Because I see my mom who's in her 80s now, and she really can't anymore. There really is a time limit of when you can just go out and do the things that you've been dreaming of doing. Like, this is it. This is the time.
What are you really fucking good at?
Tuning in and understanding the person in front of me. It's my superpower.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Tracy. If people want to learn more about you, about Catalyst Constellations, about the book, they want to pre-order the book, where can they go?
CatalystConstellations.com is the preeminent place. We'll be updating the website with pre-order information for the book within the next few weeks. So that will be up. It's not up today, but it will be soon.
Amazing. And are you on the socials?
LinkedIn is the best social to get me on. The others I am on, but not great at responding. And Facebook, I don't get on at all anymore.
Oh man, we could have a whole other conversation about Facebook.
Yes, we could. Yes, we could.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Cassandra. Enjoy your afternoon.
I hope you enjoyed chatting with Tracy as much as I did. If you've enjoyed the series so far, please do subscribe, rate, and leave a review. It really does help put the series in front of more badass women, and a few men too, by increasing how we rank. You should also check out the show notes for more info on Tracy, Catalyst Constellations, and to pre-order the book. And follow us on Insta and all the socials at SoapboxWork. As always, if you've got a story and you want to tell it like it is, I'd love to hear from you. Get in touch with me over at soapbox.work.